What chapter, do you remember what chapter records the conclusion of Nehemiah's mission when he came to Jerusalem? It's close. Chapter 6, verse 15, right? They finished the wall in 52 days. But the book doesn't end there. And so now, really your answer about chapter 7 is not wrong, because this is something else he wanted to do. What did he begin to do in chapter 7? Secure the city. And one of the things he attacks now, problem he attacks, is the lack of people in the city. People would stand post around the walls by their house and other appointed places, and there wasn't enough population in the city. And so he began to address that, chapter 7, but there's an interruption in that. At the end of chapter 7, it says the seventh month came, and you have the events of chapter 8. 9 and 10. And so he resumes that in chapter 11, where he is still working on this matter of populating the city. And so 1 out of 10 volunteered to go live in Jerusalem. And then you have a list of some of the different groups there in chapter 11. Then you have people that lived in the cities at the end of chapter 11. And then at the chapter 12, the first 26 verses, you have priests and Levites who returned with Zerubbabel. And we'll not spend much time on that. We've been over these lists, Ezra 2, earlier in the book of Nehemiah, and he's got a list here. What these do show is that this is a historical book and designed for the history of the Jews. Okay, so let's go down to verse 27. We'll start our study there tonight. And on your lesson, I don't remember if we did this in class or not, 12, 27 through 43, this section's about what? Dedication of the wall, that's right. So back 6:15, they finished the wall. This section is about dedication of that wall. Now before we look at 12:27 following, I want you to go to 13:4. Look at 13:4. There's a little time note right there. It says prior to this, but prior to this. This what? I think that he's referring back to the events that begin in 12:27. Can't be definitive about that, but that's what makes the most sense to me, at least. Prior to this. So if that's correct in 13:4, prior to this, then he talks about some events that happened prior to the dedication of the wall, and he tells you in verse 6 of chapter 13 that during this time some things went on and he wasn't in Jerusalem. See verse 6, during all this time I was not in Jerusalem. For the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had gone to the king. After some time, however, I asked leave from the king and came to Jerusalem. So he was in Jerusalem. We ask you this question on your sheet. How many years as governor? Where did you get?
No, not 12.
Is it 12 or 20? You said 20 and you said 12.
It's 12.
12. You got a 50-50 chance of getting it. All right. I'm glad somebody else gets mixed up beside me. So that's good. 12. 12 years, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of Artaxerxes. And then he went back to the king. Why did he go back? I don't know. After some time, he returned to Jerusalem. How long? Don't know. But in that time he was gone, we're going to read about some of the things that happened there in Jerusalem that he got back and he had to address and correct. But anyway, if we're right about that time note, and if 1227 then actually refers to the period after he got back from Babylon, then the dedication of the wall followed the finishing of the wall by about 12 years. Because the wall was finished in 52 days, wasn't it? By the time he got there, got to work on it. And he was governor 12 years. He left and came back. And so if this follows that, the dedication followed that 12 years. So a question arises, why 12-year delay? I don't know. I don't know. And I've not found anybody else that knows. The research I've done. There are some suggestions, however. Back in Ezra chapter 4, do you remember back in Ezra chapter 4 when those who were trying to discourage them from building the temple, they wrote a letter. What did they accuse those who were building Jerusalem, what did they say? They said, if they build this city and finish its walls, what's going to happen? They're going to rebel against the king. They're not going to pay taxes. And so you remember the work was stopped, which wasn't true, but that's what they said. Anyway, Haggai and Zechariah come on the scene, encourage them, and they get the temple built. Now, Nehemiah comes over here, and he starts rebuilding the wall. Look back in chapter 6. You know, Sanballat is trying various things to ensnare Nehemiah. He's having difficulty. Nehemiah is not falling for any of it. So down in verse 6 and 7, what does Sanballat say? There's a report about Nehemiah, about he's going to do what? I heard something.
Rebel.
And he's going to be the king. Nehemiah said, you invented all that in your mind. Verse 8, that's not so. So now they've finished the wall. Is the delay in the dedication so that he can get the king's permission, so that there's no political ramifications or repercussions? Don't know. I don't know. But nevertheless, if we're right about the time, as you start reading in 1227, it's after he got back from Jerusalem that these events take place. And those events, 1227 through 43, are tied together with 44 with that first phrase, on that day. You see it, 1243 on that day, 1244 on that day, 13:1 on that day. But then you have that time note in 13:4, prior to this. Okay, so that's not important, but just something to note when you study Nehemiah, just be aware of that. Okay, so we're looking at the dedication of the wall, and there's not a whole lot we'll note about that, except that the wall was finished, and there's a celebration of joy and thanksgiving for their accomplishment. Verse 27, now at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought out Levites from all their places to bring them to Jerusalem so that they might celebrate the dedication with gladness and hymns of thanksgiving and with songs to the accompaniment of cymbals, harps, and lyres. And so all these people gathered. And he had two groups get up on the wall and meet as they marched. Must have been big walls, huh? And, of course, those walls around those cities were. You had the verse 38, the second choir proceeded to the left. And so you had these two groups. And then they met and then they celebrated the dedication of the wall. Verse 43, on that day they offered great sacrifices and rejoiced because God had given them great joy. Even the women and children rejoiced so that the joy of Jerusalem was heard from afar. Okay. Now, 1244, we talked about on your lesson, question number 2 here on chapter 12, 44 through 31, that Nehemiah instituted 2 reforms. And one of those reforms, 1244 through 47, had to do with what?
Supporting the priest.
And you see this, he said, on that day men were also appointed over the chambers for the stores, the contribution of the first fruits and the tithes. And remember, we talked about this in a previous lesson. In fact, why is he setting this up? Hadn't he already set this up? Didn't we read about this back in chapter 10? Look back at chapter 10. Verse 32 through 39, what's the key phrase? We talked about that in class.
The house of our God.
The house of our God, that's right. And the summary statements at the end of verse 39. What's all this about? The house of our God. We'll not neglect the house of our God. And it's not the building itself. The house is put for the worship that takes place in it. That's the idea. In other words, we're not going to neglect providing for and attending to the worship of the God of this house. And so you have all these provisions, the shekel in verse 32, the supply of wood in verse 34, then verse 35 following, the first fruits and the firstborn of the sons, and those kind of things, verse 38, the tithes, all that there. Now, it says in 12:44, men were appointed over the chambers for the stores, the contribution, the first fruits, the tithes, etc. And why... If you read chapter 13, and if we're right about our time sequence, you know now why you're reading this in 1244. What happened between chapter 10 and 1244? In chapter 13, verse 4, prior to this, prior to the dedication of the wall and these reforms, what had happened when he was not in Jerusalem? Elisha the priest, and this is one of the questions we have on your sheet, number 4. Elisha the priest, who was appointed over the chambers of the house of our God, being related to Tobiah. Now, who's Tobiah? We studied about him in a previous class. What was he, an Israelite? No, he was an Ammonite. And back in chapter 6, if you look at chapter 6, remember Tobiah and Sanballat were two of his enemies as he tried to build this wall. And then in chapter 6, verse 17, in those days many letters went from the nobles of Judah to Tobiah. And Tobiah's letters came to them. For many in Judah were bound by oath to him because of why? Marriage, right? Family. Because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Ara, and his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshulam, the son of Berechiah. So there's a relation of marriage. There's some ties here. And you see in the last verse of the chapter, they were speaking about his good deeds in my presence and reported my words to him. Then Tobiah sent letters to frighten me. The chambers in the house of God are supposed to be for what when you read 1244 following?
Preaching.
Do what?
To hold the utensils and the grain offerings.
All the offerings and those kind of things that are brought, that's what they're there for. Those things that are designed to support those who serve there, the Levites, the singers, those people. That's what they're for. You see that in 1244. Men were appointed over the chambers for the stores, the contribution, the first fruits and the tithes, to gather them from the fields and the cities, the portions required by the law for the priest and Levites. For Judah rejoiced over the priests and Levites who served. And when there's that attitude that they're glad to have men who are serving in the capacity God appointed them, people will willingly and joyfully provide for their support. And that's what you're reading about right here. And so he said, for they performed the worship of their God in the service of purification, together with the singers and the gatekeepers, in accordance with the commandment of David and his son Solomon. You remember David and Solomon set a lot of this up. So that's what these chambers were for. People brought in the first fruits of their ground and their tithes and those kind of things. There were rooms for to store all of that. But you see in chapter 13, verse 4, that this Eliashib, the priest, who should have been taking care of all of that, was actually in alliance with Tobiah and had prepared a large room for him, where formerly they put the grain offerings, the frankincense, the utensils, the tithes of grain, wine, and oil prescribed for the Levites, the singers and the gatekeepers. That's why there's a need for this reform in 1244 following. That had been set up, but now it's been violated. It's fallen through the cracks because of ties, family ties, friend ties with this Ammonite. You would think Eliashib, being a priest, would put the other priest and Levites ahead. But remember, they're family ties. And many times people put their family before their brethren. And so this is what was going on. And then when you get down to verse 6, he explains further, during all this time I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I'd gone to the king. After some time, however, I asked leave from the king, and I came to Jerusalem and learned about the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah. Evil, did he murder? Did he steal? Did he commit adultery? Is that the kind of evil? No, it's the evil of corrupting the worship, God's order, God's plan. It's evil. And by preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of our God. So what difference does it make? The difference is God had a plan, and this was his plan to support the worship in the house of God. And it was evil to violate that. And that had happened during his absence. So you have these reformers that you read about in 1244 through 47. Also, you have the reforms that you read about 13:1-3. And we ask you that on your sheet, I think, somewhere. Yes. Question number 2. What other reforms did he institute? What? Exclude the foreigners. They read aloud from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people, and there was found written in it that no Ammonite or Moabite should enter the assembly of God, because they did not meet the sons of Israel with bread and water, but hired Balaam against them to curse them. However, our God turned the curse into a blessing. So when they heard the law, they excluded all foreigners from Israel. According to Nehemiah's writing, what caused them to exclude somebody? They heard the word. They read the law. I just preached a lesson on withdrawing a couple weeks ago. What's going to cause us to exclude from our association God, the ones God said to exclude from our association? Here's the answer right here. Is that mean? Is that hateful? No. This is God's plan. This was God's plan for them. We have a plan today. And when they heard the law, they excluded all foreigners from Israel. Now, whether people like it or don't like it or can explain it or can't explain it, this was God's plan. So those two reforms you read about in 1244 through chapter 13, verse 3. Okay, so he found out what had been done in his absence. And that answered number 4, 13, 4 through 9. In verse 8, he said, it was very displeasing to me, so I threw all of Tobiah's household goods out of the room. That would have been interesting to see, wouldn't it? I wonder if he just threw them out in the courtyard. Threw them out. And I gave an order, and they cleansed the rooms, and I returned there the utensils of the house of God with the grain offerings and the frankincense. All right, then we have another thing that he found that had been going on. Verse 10 through 14. What else?
The Levites
had not been given their portions. So what did the Levites do, does it say in verse 10? Went to their field. They're going to find some kind of employment to support themselves and their family. But that wasn't God's plan. God's plan was that the nation support them while they do this work. That's what the tithes were for. And in 1 Corinthians 9, Paul used this kind of thing to talk about the support of preachers. And so, because these men weren't adequately being taken care of, they said, we've got to go get some secular work. But that wasn't God's plan, and Nehemiah wasn't pleased with it. So I reprimanded the officials, those who should have been in charge of this, see if this didn't happen, and said, here it is again. Why is the house of God forsaken? Is it the building he's concerned about? No, the worship that goes on in the building. They're designed to keep these people close to God and serving God. Then I gathered them together and restored them to their post. All Judah then brought the tithe of the grain, wine, and oil into the storehouses. In charge of the storehouses, I appointed Shelemiah the priest, Zadok the scribe, Bedaiah the Levites. In addition to them was Hanan the son of Zachar, the son of Mattaniah, for they were considered reliable. Remember back in chapter 7, in verse 2, when he was securing the city, gates were being hung. People were being appointed to post to guard the city. He put Hananiah, my brother, and Hananiah, the commander of the fortress, in charge of Jerusalem, for he was a faithful man and feared God more than many. And so God needs faithful men, men who can be trusted, men who are trustworthy, men who are reliable to do various tasks related to his work. And that's what he did here. And so this coincides with these reforms that you read about back in chapter 12 and verse 44 following. Now, here it says the Levites went to their field in 13:10, but these reforms were instituted and the people joined heartily in doing it. And what's the reason giving that they joined heartily in doing it in 12:44? What attitude did they have? They rejoiced over the people who served. They were glad to have these men who were dedicated to that work and to have a share in their support. And that was God's plan. Verse 14 is a statement we've read several times throughout the book. Remember me for this, O my God, and do not blot out my loyal deeds which I perform for the house of my God and its services. We trace that throughout the book, trying to keep God's plan in order, whether it be providing for those who serve, whether it be the matter of excluding foreigners, whether it may be the matter of intermarriage, whether it be the matter of keeping his own brethren from oppressing one another. We read about chapter 5. It said, remember me, O God, for the work that I do. That's a legitimate thing to pray. And God does remember people when they have the courage and the love for him and his people to do what is right. Okay, verse 15 following. We have number 5. What other departures from the law did he discover? In verse 15 through 18, and you could go on through 22, because 19 through 22 had to do with the reforms or the measures that were taken to correct this. But what departure do you find in 15 through 18?
Work on the Sabbath, make it land.
Okay, profaning the Sabbath. In fact, that very term is used here. He said, verse 17, that they were profaning the Sabbath. Profaning, making it like a common day. You have again that word in verse 18. And so, note in verse 22, in contrast to profaning the Sabbath, verse 22 is what?
Sanctify.
Sanctify means set apart. Doesn't mean the Sabbath day is sinless. That's not the point. Setting apart, it's a special day. They were treating it like any other day of the week. And yet this was a special day to this nation because it was a mark of their deliverance from Egypt by this God and the law that was given them. And so there was the profaning of the Sabbath. So verse 15, in those days I saw in Judah some who were treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in sacks of grain and loading them on donkeys, as well as wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of loads. And they brought them into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. What if they said, man, we got to work? We can't take a day off from selling our goods. Doesn't work justify everything? I mean, we know murder's not justified and adultery and stealing, but work. Work. Isn't that right next to God?
That's 6 days to do that.
In their case, 6 days to do it. Well, wait a minute. Back when they were traveling through the wilderness, doesn't this present a problem? God's feeding them every day. And they can only gather that food on 6 days. Are they just not eat on the seventh day? Is that a day of starvation or something? God provided for 2 days on the... That's right. And you had to trust God. Did everybody trust Him?
No.
Some were out trying to gather on the seventh day. Normally the food wouldn't last over a day, but for those 2 days it would. Just trust God. We don't have a Sabbath rest today. We're not under that law. But the point is, there is a point here about trust and putting God first. And today we don't have a Sabbath day, but I'll tell you what, folks, we have a society in which work excuses everything. People not spending time with their families, people not having time to study the Bible, people not having time to worship. Gotta work. Gotta work. So, you see the problem here. And so, I admonished them, verse 15, on the day they sold food. Also, men of Tyre were living and there who imported fish and all kinds of merchandise and sold them with the sons of Judah on the Sabbath, even in Jerusalem. When he forbade this, it was going to affect the economy of people. A lot of things you can do, but don't touch my pocketbook. That didn't make Nehemiah any difference, did it? And our political leaders often selected on one consideration. How's it going to affect my pocketbook? Not their morals, not their stance on faith or religion or God. Just one thing. How's it going to affect my pocketbook? But Nehemiah wasn't concerned about that. I reprimanded the nobles of Judah and said to them, "What is this evil thing you are doing by profaning the Sabbath? Did not your fathers do the same, so that our God brought on us and on this city all this trouble? You're adding to the wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath." So he took some measures to prevent it. Verse 19, just as it grew dark at the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath, I commanded the doors be shut, that they should not open them till after the Sabbath. Then I stationed some of my servants at the gates so that no load would enter on the Sabbath. Once or twice, the traders and merchants of every kind of merchandise spent the night outside Jerusalem. And I warned them and said, why do you spend the night in front of the wall? If you do so again, I'll use force against you. From that time on, they did not come on the Sabbath. I commanded the Levites that they should purify themselves and come as gatekeepers to sanctify the Sabbath day. For this also remember me, O my God, and have compassion on me according to the greatness of your loving kindness. Have compassion on a man who forbade people to trade, who warned them, don't you come to this gate again and camp here. God's going to be compassionate to that kind of guy? Yes, sir. He was a leader. He had faith. He was trying to implement God's plan. You reckon everybody liked him? You bet they didn't. But that wasn't his concern. They were doing what was right. Nehemiah is a great book to study about leadership. Great example of leadership. All right, then we ask you a question on the sheet. What other problem did he address here? Intermarriage. When did you read about that being a problem before? Let me really back up. When's the first time that you read about a warning about that? About the nation of Israel intermarrying foreign people. What? Before Joshua. The law of Moses. Back in the book of Deuteronomy, in that sermon Moses preached before they went into the promised land, he warned them, do not intermarry. He warned them in that sermon. So about when was that? What time are we at here? Approximately. Huh? 450, let's say. 1,000 years later, we're still dealing with the same problem. Solomon became king about 931, somewhere along in there. 971 to 31, he was king right in that period. What led him astray? Intermarriage. So, Moses warned about it in his sermon. 500 years later, Solomon's practicing it. Became a problem for the rest of their time. Ezra comes back. When did Ezra come back? Ah, these dates are fun, aren't they? 458, that's right. Ezra came back 458. And what did he find? Intermarriage. Ezra 9 and 10. Okay. They put away their wives. They said, we're going to do this. They all pledged. You think, boy, I got that one squared away now. You know, Solomon did this. God sent them prophet and prophet and prophet. They wouldn't listen, so they're taken into captivity. You think, boy, they've learned their lesson. They come out of captivity. They're doing it again. Ezra comes. He's a teacher. He teaches and he teaches. Finds this problem. Prays about it. Gets the people to join him. They correct the problem. 458. Now Nehemiah comes back. So what are we talking about, 13, 14 years later? We got the problem again. I don't know what you get out of this. I'll tell you one lesson I get out of this. As a teacher, you would hope that you'd teach on something, people would get it, and that would be it. But it don't work that way. You think of our Lord. He taught for 3 years. When he got through to the end of 3 years, the apostles still didn't get a number of things he taught. And so as teachers, we can get discouraged because we teach and we teach. And people go say, I'm going to do better. And then next thing you know, they're back at it again. But you know what? That'll help us is to look in the mirror. We fail. Let's not be guilty. We can't be. Maybe we can't do anything about the other fella, but we can do something about us. And so here you see them intermarrying. Verse 23, in those days I saw that the Jews had married women from Ashdod, Ammon and Moab. As for their children, half spoken the language of Ashdod, and none of them was able to speak the language of Judah, but the language of his own people. So the intermarriage was affecting somebody besides the people that married, wasn't it? Affecting the children. What's going to happen next generation? And so I contended with them and cursed them. This is not cuss them. He didn't cuss them, he cursed them. There's a difference. That is to pronounce upon them the judgments of God for what they'd done. And struck some of them. What did he do to strike them? I do not know. We do not know. The text does not say. Was it a judgmental type whipping that took place? I don't know. The next, they did have those kind of things, but this next statement, I don't remember in the book of Deuteronomy, the judge is told to do this kind of thing. And I sure would like to know more about this. It says, he pulled out their hair. Did he just grab it and pull it out? I don't know. I can't imagine it being anything but painful. And so he pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, you shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor take of their daughters for your sons or for yourselves. Well, that's what Moses said 1,000 years previous. And that's what they had covenanted to in the time of Ezra. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin regarding these things? Yet among the many nations there was no king like him, and he was loved by his God. God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, the foreign women caused even him to sin. Wisest man on all the earth when he lived. But the foreign women caused him to sin. Do we then hear about you that you've committed all this great evil by acting unfaithfully against our God by marrying foreign women? Even one of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Elisha, the high priest, was son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite. So I invited him over for supper to try to make friends with you. Know what it says? Drug him away. What kind of guy is this Nehemiah anyway? God-fearing man with courage. Winning friends and influencing people is not his number one priority. He wants to influence them, all right, but he wants to influence them for God. Whether they like him or don't like him is not really the criteria. Remember me, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. Then in verse 30, we have a summary statement. Thus I purified them. And you note that thus. This just kind of summarizes what you've been reading about from 1244 on. All these reforms. Remember, we put all this in one section, 1244 through 1331. So we put that all in a section. Reforms that Nehemiah put in place. And here's your summary statement. Thus, that is, I just talked about, wrote about all of this. Here's what I did. I purified them from everything foreign and appointed duties for the priests and the Levites, each in his task. This is not something new. He's rehearsing. He's summarizing what you just read that he did. And I arranged for the supply of wood at appointed times and for the first fruits. Remember me, O my God, for good. Any comments, observations, thoughts on this section we've studied?
Well, this is still kind of heavy on times today in America, wasn't it? I mean, judgment and some of these kind of things.
They would what, Annis, speak up?
I'm saying that this type of behavior to correct problems, you know, but it'd be kind of a problem thing in our country, you know, in a way we're not used to this type of.
We don't have this kind of leaders.
Yeah,
first of all, we don't have people who fear God, first of all. And we have leaders more interested in being reelected than doing what's right. Of course, Nehemiah's role wasn't an elected role. He didn't have to run for office.
But it is good to show us how our attitudes should be toward God, serving God, doing God's will.
That's right. And this is right. It is a good, he's a role model for us. It's showing the courage we ought to have, even if we're not in his position, the courage we ought to have in doing the will of God. And if necessary, standing against those who are friends and those of the same faith as us. He reprimanded the officials. I don't imagine they appreciated that. Do you?
No. When Jesus said he's going to bring a sword and divide families, mother and son and daughter. I mean, this is it's hard. It's hard for people to see this and think this. I mean, this is what happened when people made the gospel in the first century.
That's right.
You had people that were against each other. They were separate in ideas and thoughts and beliefs. But the first thing they had put first in their life was God and God's family, serving God first.
And it's exactly right. And the beautiful thing about it is, when eternity comes, it's these kind of people we'll be with. Men like Moses, men like Nehemiah, men like Daniel, men like Paul. That's the kind of people we'll enjoy being with in eternity. And family ties are not the criteria. Okay? Any other comments or questions? Thank you for your good attention. We've studied the book of Nehemiah. The Lord willing, Sunday morning, we'll begin the book of Esther.